Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. Today is Thursday, June 8, 2023. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page this morning, Making a Statement is the title. Across a photo that reads, Dr. Dan Yeager and his wife, Janine, work to steady the giant inflatable pink ribbon they made before a measurement could be taken Wednesday in front of the Hall Perrin Cancer Center in southeast Cedar Rapids. The inflatable ribbon was constructed and donated to the Especially For You race by the Yeagers. The couple wanted to give back by helping to create awareness for the Especially For You race after Janine's battle with the disease, for which she was treated at the center. It took the Yeagers 2 to 3 weeks to sew the 52 yards of 1.9-ounce ripstop nylon into the iconic ribbon. If approved, the official measurement of 25 feet 2.5 inches will set the Guinness World Record for largest inflatable awareness ribbon. Also on the front page today, this story is by Diana Nolan, Eastern Iowan's Flight to End Polio Back on Track. Pilots Peter Tian of Robbins and John Okenfels of Shoeyville aren't merely flying around the world to raise funds for Rotary International's efforts to end polio. They've stepped into the front lines of the battle's epicenter, administering vaccines to children in and around Karachi, Pakistan this week. I think I was fairly well-versed and informed on polio eradication over the years, and I had a clue what was going on, Okenfels told the Gazette by phone Wednesday. But what I really saw today opened my eyes even much more than what I knew before, so this is a valuable stop. This is without a doubt, and we've had some great stops, but from the meaningfulness of the trip, this is the one that's really lit the candle for me, he said. This started to be a trip around the world, Tian added, and then it started to be a fundraiser around the world. And for myself, this trip has become more of a spiritual journey. It is captured in the experience of watching a child open his mouth or her mouth, and by putting two drops in there, knowing that you prevented this child from getting polio, when polio is so present with the children around here. And it's all because people donated to the Flight to End Polio that we're even here, Tian said. In a small world moment, one of the first people they met from various Pakistani aid organizations was Nofil Naqi, Media and Communications Officer for UNICEF in Karachi. The first thing out of his mouth, he said, is, Hi, welcome. I attended Coe College in Cedar Rapids, said Tian, who also went to Coe, as did Okenfels's wife. Naqi studied there in 1996, Tian noted. Now, 1 month into their 3-month flight, circumnavigating the globe, Tian and Okenfels are astonished to discover the eyes of the world are on them. They've been surprised to hear from people far and wide who are following their progress via the Flight Aware link on their website, flighttoendpolio.com. I really didn't think people would do that, but they are, Tian said. It's amazing the comments we get. And they're being treated like rock stars at all of their stops, but especially in Pakistan, one of two remaining hotspots for polio. The other is Afghanistan, where the pilots aren't allowed to venture, but where Rotary International is working to eradicate the crippling disease. They're so exhausted in the flight, Tian said of the Pakistanis. They're so exhausted in the fight. But they're not going to give it up, and they just feel blessed by what John and I are representing. It's not just John and Peter. We're representing all the people we're meeting around the world, raising money to let them know they're not alone in this fight. And together, we're no longer hoping. We believe that as a world together, we're going to put an end to this polio virus, and children will be safe once and for all. I didn't really have a clue how big a deal it was for two over-the-hill guys from the United States to show up in Karachi, Pakistan, said Okenfels, who turned 71 in Iceland on May 19, celebrating with a toast. Tian will turn 70 on June 17 in India, where Okenfels teased that he's heard birthdays are celebrated in a big way. The two flying Rotarians, whose wives are cousins, have weathered their fair share of turbulence in their quest to not only join the ranks of 700 pilots who have circled the globe in a single engine airplane since aviation began, but more importantly, to aid in Rotary International's quest to end polio through vaccinations and water purification programs. The pilot spoke to the Gazette from Pakistan on Tuesday as well, describing the emotional roller coaster they've been on since experiencing mechanical issues in New Hampshire that stalled their flight for a week, bad weather in Canada that grounded them for another week. As a result, they had to alter their flight plan and miss several in-person fundraising receptions in Europe. They were able to connect virtually to events in Denmark and Portugal, and other events went on as scheduled even without the guests of honor. The pilots had to push on because we couldn't go back, Achenfels said. There was no way to catch up because the sessions were already happening. They were all pre-planned. These were some pretty elaborate events in a couple places, so they're having them whether we're there or not. With a 2-to-1 match through the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Tian and Achenfels already had reached their initial goal of raising $1 million by the time they left Cedar Rapids on May 5. More money has been raised during the first week of the trek, but the numbers haven't been finalized yet, the pilot said. According to their May 30 newsletter, an event in Cascais, Portugal, which involved 45 Rotary and Rotarian clubs and was time-stamped May 22nd on Facebook, they raised more than $77,000 in addition to another fundraiser in Portugal in December. The pilots are paying all the bills associated with the flight, augmented by some corporate grants and equipment donations, so all funds raised go directly to the Rotary Foundation's Polio Plus program, outlined at flighttoendpolio.com/end-polio. The flight has been back on track since landing in the Netherlands May 23, Tian noted, and while they haven't been able to do all the sightseeing they had planned, including a much-anticipated trip to Normandy for Achenfels' birthday, they've had many unexpected pleasures along the way. We've gotten to see some interesting territory we would have never seen before, such as Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, and Iceland, Achenfels said. While waiting for the weather to clear up in Iceland, they had time to rent a car and explore. One of their favorite spots was the huge Sky Lagoon hot water spa. It was very strange to be standing in hot water while I was getting hit with ice, Achenfels wrote in their May 30 newsletter. They also enjoyed seeing the waterfalls in Iceland, riding the rides at the Europa Park theme park in Lahr, Germany, and driving around Abu Dhabi while they visited the opulent Sheikh Zayed Grand Mosque Center. But the most impressive sight was in the middle of nowhere. I'm just mind-boggled by the desert, Tian said. We did 6 hours flying over Saudi Arabia, and it's all desert, Achenfels said, adding that if they should need to make an emergency landing, he'd rather land in the ocean than in the desert, where the temperatures rose to 120 to 130 degrees. It was as far as you can see with sand and nobody else, Tian said. It was intense. As beautiful as the green was and the ocean was, the beauty and the intimidation of the desert, it is stark beauty. The mountains leaving Abu Dhabi caught Achenfels' attention. Just before we got to the ocean, we were at 11,000 feet and planned to climb to 12,000 to get over those ridges, he said. And at 12,000 feet, the top of that ridge was not very far below us. I skirted that one, which made for some pretty good photographs. On Friday, they'll leave for a whirlwind trip through India, then land June 18 in Sri Lanka, before heading on to Thailand and points east. The concluding goal remains the same as the starting goal, to return safely to their wives in Cedar Rapids on July 30. Also on the front page, Relief Plan honored with Top Urban Design Award. This story is by Marissa Payne. When Cedar Rapids officials set out to craft an urban forestation plan after the 2020 derecho's ferocious winds toppled most of the tree canopy, they hoped it would be a model for other communities to follow after a natural disaster to revive their canopies. Recognition that the Relief Cedar Rapids plan received last week moves the team closer to that goal. Relieve Cedar Rapids is a public-private partnership between the city, Marion-based nonprofit Trees Forever, and expert consultants. The ambitious $37 million plan to replenish Cedar Rapids' decimated tree canopy in 10 years was honored in Charlotte, North Carolina, with the Congress for the New Urbanism 2023 Charter Award in the region, metropolis, city, and town category. This is the leading organization that promotes walkable, mixed-use development, sustainable communities, and healthier living conditions. Speck and Associates, led by renowned city planner Jeff Speck and local landscape architect firm Confluence, were specifically recognized. Other recipients of the Charter Award, which is the world's preeminent award for urban design, placemaking, and community building, include Albany Skyway in Albany, New York, Hearth in the Hearth category, Memorial to the Enslaved at William and Mary in Williamsburg, Larkin Place in Elgin, Illinois, and Pullman Art Space Lofts in Chicago. When you see the other communities being acknowledged, it's nice to be recognized because this will help us get the word out to other communities about what we've done in Cedar Rapids, City Manager Jeff Pomerantz said. The full list of Charter, Merit, and Student Award winners is available online. Speck said that attendees of the conference, which draws developers, bankers, municipal officials, and others from around the world who are invested in making better, more workable places, embrace the plan's intersection between urban forestry and placemaking. They also were shocked and compelled by Cedar Rapids' derecho story. Seeing the relief plan, Speck said they were interested in how the relief rules might apply to other places across the world, particularly in the U.S. In the 10th anniversary edition of Speck's best-selling urban design book, Walkable City, he included the story of the derecho and relief Cedar Rapids. The plan calls for the replanting of 42,000 trees on public parks and rights-of-way, with a focus on equity and placemaking, prioritizing the most vulnerable neighborhoods. It also includes principles that any property owner can follow to replant their own private properties. Big, not small. A small species tree should not be planted where a large species tree will thrive. Locals, not imports. Native trees that support native animals and insects should be planted to fuel the food web. Tots, not teens. Trees should be planted when they're young if they can be protected. Transplanting a more mature tree can curtail its growth. And let trees mingle. Trees planted close together share nutrients and information through their root systems, so they should be planted close together where possible. I'm hopeful the plan's dissemination encourages a lot of people to look at their own yards and properties and do their part, Speck said. Not being an urban forester, Speck said it was a tremendous amount of work for Confluence to teach him an old dog learning new tricks. It gives me a real sense of accomplishment to have gone outside my comfort zone, to have learned new stuff that I hope will benefit Cedar Rapids, Speck said. You get out of life what you put into it, and if effort's any indication, I put a lot into this plan. Pomerantz quickly mobilized the relief partners not long after the derecho struck Cedar Rapids to begin work toward ensuring future generations could have a diverse tree canopy to enjoy. The city's swift response to the loss of trees and effort to draft a reforestation plan can be a model to other communities, Pomerantz said. The work we're doing to plant trees and the number of trees has not been done anywhere else in the world, Pomerantz said. We're very pleased to be a model for other communities across the world as events have taken trees from their community. According to a city dashboard, 4,708 relief trees have been planted so far. The city has committed at least $1 million annually toward relief for 10 years, plus funds to water the new trees. Since the Cedar Rapids City Council adopted the relief plan in February 2022, Trees Forever has worked to rally support among private donors and mobilize volunteers around the replanting effort. Programs such as neighborhood tree captains work to rally community involvement at a grassroots level. Shannon Ramsay, Trees Forever founder and foundation trustee, said the award puts the importance of urban forests at the forefront of the urban planning realm. It is forward thinking, Ramsay said of the plan. There's never been a plan like it in the world of planning. It's key that the partnership maintains momentum with the entire community, Ramsay said. Trees Forever is nearly halfway to its private fundraising goal of $7 million. The city and Trees Forever are also seeking tree planting funds through the Federal Inflation Reduction Act. We have tremendous volunteer help at all levels, whether it's planting or watering or helping raise dollars, Ramsay said. Turning to Iowa Today, this caption rather, of a photo shows Kayla Workman of Norwalk, who cuts a tree root Wednesday as she prepares a place for a 165-pound limestone step at Palisades Kepler State Park in rural Mount Vernon. Sprucing up Palisades is the caption above the photo. A team from the Conservation Corps, Minnesota, and Iowa leveled the ground and set up about 40 limestone steps leading to Cedar Cliff. The crews also put down 60 tons of gravel along Cool Hollow Trail. A smaller crew will be back in late summer or early fall to complete the work on the steps. In other Iowa Today news, shots fired incident at Cedar Rapids pool sends swimmers to safety. Swimmers at Knoll Ridge Aquatic Center in northeast Cedar Rapids were taken into safe housing on site Wednesday after reports of shots being fired nearby. Police received a report of shots fired in the 4,000 block of Richmond Road Northeast at 4:41 p.m. Wednesday, according to a news release. Officers arrived on scene as witnesses described three boys involved in an altercation that ended in a single gunshot being fired. The release states the individuals fled before officers arrived. No injuries or property damage had been reported as of Wednesday evening. Knoll Ridge Aquatic Center, which is about a block from the location of the shots fired, was secured by staff, and swimmers were taken into safe housing on site until police indicated all was clear. The pool was scheduled to reopen at 6:30 for normal operations. The incident appears to have been a targeted event, the release states, and there is no evident threat of public safety. An investigation into the incident is ongoing. Police are asking witnesses to come forward with information by calling Linn County Crime Stoppers at 800-272-7463. And a crash victim has been identified. A man who was killed in a crash Tuesday morning in Linn County has been identified as David Dixon, age 50, of Marion, by the Linn County Sheriff's Office. Dixon was the passenger in a 2008 Nissan Rogue that was driving north on North 10th Street when it was hit by a semi-truck traveling west on County Home Road. The Nissan was pushed into the yard of a vacant house at 2409 County Home Road. The sheriff's office responded to the crash just before 11:30 a.m. Tuesday. Dixon was pronounced dead at the scene, and the driver of the Nissan, Aubrey Greiner, 18, of Edel, was taken to a hospital with serious injuries. James Schmidt, 74, of Earlville, was driving the semi and suffered a minor injury. The sheriff's office assisted at the scene by the Marion Fire Department and Iowa Department of Public Safety Motor Vehicle Enforcement. The crash remains under investigation by the sheriff's office. Turning now to the Insight page, the guest editorial today is a reprint from the Los Angeles Times. This appeared Wednesday. Migrants are people, not political pawns. California officials are considering filing civil and criminal charges for what they call state-sanctioned kidnapping against whoever is responsible for flying migrants from the U.S.-Mexican border region to Sacramento on two planes the last few days. According to California Attorney General Rob Bonta, the two planes carrying migrants from South America were chartered by the state of Florida, the very state whose legislature recently passed a bill calling for prison time for anyone caught transporting undocumented immigrants. Nevertheless, these same Florida legislators have supported Republican Governor Ron DeSantis' scheme to transport migrants from anywhere in the country to liberal so-called sanctuary cities, expanding his vigorous program that flew migrants to Martha's Vineyard. Migrants are human beings, not cargo to be shipped around without regard to their humanity. Sacramento migrant aid workers said the migrants who were abandoned in front of the Roman Catholic Diocese in Sacramento on Friday had no idea what city or state they were in. The 12 men and 4 women from Venezuela and Colombia said they had been approached at a migrant center in El Paso and told they would be taken to a place where they could get jobs and services. A second flight of 20 migrants arrived at a Sacramento airport from New Mexico on Monday morning. When migrants arrive at the border, they are typically processed by immigration authorities who assign them a court date, moving people across the country without regard to their ability to get to their court hearings is likely to jeopardize their immigration cases. But these deceptive and cruel migrant transport programs aren't designed to help vulnerable men and women who made harrowing journeys through jungles and dangerous terrain in the hope of a better life in the U.S. These are political stunts. DeSantis and GOP Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who bussed migrants to Vice President Kamala Harris's home in Washington last year, are ostensibly trying to make a statement against President Joe Biden's border policies. The reality is that the border is highly guarded and fortified by walled areas, and there aren't many legal ways for people to migrate. There's no question that migration has put tremendous pressure on border communities, but real leaders try to solve problems, not worsen them with cruel tricks or political stunts. 24-hour Doorman today. Who targets books? It's confidential. A couple of weeks ago, the Washington Post published a fascinating analysis of book challenges filed in school districts across the country. The Post looked at challenges in more than 100 school districts in 37 states, where local officials provided 1,065 challenges filed in their districts. 43% of the books challenged included LGBTQ characters or storylines, and another 36% had characters of color dealing with issues of race. The number one reason books were challenged was sexual content, the Post found. That's not surprising to anyone who has followed efforts here in Iowa by Governor Kim Reynolds and the Republican legislature to help parents who want certain books and materials removed from school libraries. Senate File 496, which Reynolds recently signed into law, directs districts to remove any books that include a depiction of a sex act. Books by LGBTQ authors and people of color have been top targets of conservative parents and groups, such as Moms for Liberty. But a second finding by the Post was more surprising. 2/3 of all the challenges filed came from a small group of people who filed 10 or more challenges, dubbed serial filers, and just 11 serial filers filed more than half the challenges, including a guy who filed 92. With Iowa's new law requiring schools to be more transparent in providing information on library materials and processes for challenging books, it would be interesting to conduct a similar analysis here. Is this a broad concern among many parents, or mainly an obsession for a small group of conservatives? Well, trouble is, the new law was written in a way to thwart such an analysis. Under the new law, quote, the identity of a parent or guardian who requests the removal of a book, article, outline, handout, video, or other education material that is available to students in the classroom or in a library offered by the school district shall be confidential and shall not be a public record subject to disclosure under Chapter 22, end quote. Chapter 22 is Iowa's open records law, but it won't apply to the names of parents who challenge books. This doesn't make much sense if you believe the bill's backers. Lawmakers insisted it will protect children and empower parents to exercise their rights. If that's the case, Why would parents not want the community to know they're protecting children? Or maybe it's because GOP lawmakers know book banning is unpopular. Also, the endless emphasis on book passages depicting sex is meant to cloak the real motive for removing books, and that's to shield kids from reading about issues, experiences, and worldviews conservatives don't like. So, book challengers get anonymity, making it tough to question their motives. It's like secret donors to dark money groups blanketing Iowa with spurious TV ads at election time. As someone who puts my name at the top of columns, I have little sympathy for anyone who wants to stir up a public debate but remain in the shadows. Confidentiality should have no place in a process that could affect public schools and students. Parents also should have a right to know who is seeking to remove books. And that's 24-Hour Dorman. He can be reached at 319-398-8262, todd.dorman@thegazette.com. One community letter today is titled, Methodist Split, More About Politics Than Christianity. The recent decision by 83 Methodist churches in Iowa to break away from the 700-plus Methodist denomination strikes me as being a reflection of the culture wars being waged by the state Republicans. I understand that the policies regarding same-sex marriage and acceptance of LGBTQ, forgive me if I missed a letter, individuals is not the only reason for the decisions to leave the larger group, but it is certainly the most advertised one. Think about the Christian philosophy regarding providing help to the unfortunate, be they lepers, political dissidents, homeless people, orphans, Jews, etc. Now, why are the various members of the LGBTQ community excluded from receiving Christian charity? I lived with a Lutheran pastor for a brief period as a teenager. I was exposed to some members of the congregation that objected to my seeing a Catholic girl. Fortunately, my pastor was completely understanding of my personal relationships. I considered myself to be agnostic, and my wife and kids are as well. Furthermore, I have had friends and employees that were members of the LGBTQ community that I have the utmost respect for. I truly wish that I could say the same for the current Republican-controlled government and any Christian body influenced by it. That letter today is signed by Gordon Taylor of Anamosa. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette today, Thursday, June 8, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we turn to today's obituary page, beginning with the short notices. First in Decora, Inez Holstad, 96, died Tuesday, June 6th, Helms Funeral Home, Decora. From Marion, Jerry D. Nagel, 66, formerly of Waukon, died Sunday, June 4. Martin Grau Funeral Home, Waukon. In Tama, Ruth, known as Elaine Hutchison, 91, died Tuesday, June 6th. Cruz Phillips Funeral Home, Tama, Toledo. In Tama, Connie Jo Smith, 69, died Tuesday, June 6th. Cruz Phillips Funeral Home. And one other death, Garth E. Willis, age 89, of Dowse, died Sunday, June 4. The Ewing Funeral Home in Dowse is assisting the family. Turning now to the regular notices, first from Cedar Rapids, Thomas Davies, age 67, passed away Monday, June 5, surrounded by family at home. Funeral service is at 10 a.m. Monday, June 12, at the Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon. Pastor Melody Williams officiating. Visitation is 1 hour prior to the service and burial at Mount Vernon Cemetery following the service. In Tom's honor, memorials may be directed to the charity that is closest to your heart. From Hiawatha, David Racer Mokal, 63, of Hiawatha, died Tuesday, June 6th. Services are at 1 p.m. Saturday, June 10, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, June 9, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. See the full obituary in Friday's paper. From Robbins, Deborah Lee Christensen, age 70, passed away May 31st at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. June 30th, with a visitation beginning at 10 a.m. at St. Mark's Lutheran in Marion. A luncheon at the church will follow. The committal will be held after the luncheon at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Please donate to the American Cancer Society in Deborah's honor. Online condolences can be directed to the family at cedarmemorial.com. From Westbrook, Minnesota, Lynette Jane Sadoff, 87, formerly of Grundy Center, Iowa, died June 3 at the Sanford Medical Center in Westbrook. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, June 8 at the Engelkes Abels Funeral and Cremation Service in Grundy Center, Iowa. A funeral service will be held at 9:30 a.m. Friday, June 9, at American Lutheran Church of Grundy Center. Burial will follow the service at Elmwood Cemetery in Dyke. From Norwalk, Stacy Gibbs Layer, an amazing wife, mother, daughter, sister, and friend, passed away peacefully at home on June 2. For the lucky ones who knew Stacy, they will remember her beautiful smile, unending strength, generous spirit, and perfect sense of humor. We will celebrate her wonderful life in a gathering at Des Moines Golf and Country Club on Thursday, June 8th from 4 to 7 p.m., and a Catholic funeral mass at Sacred Heart Parish in West Des Moines at 10 a.m. on Friday, June 9. Memorials may be made to the Food Bank of Iowa and Blank Children's Hospital Child Life Program. And lastly, from Laguna Woods, California, A. Dwayne Smith went to his heavenly home on May 3 after 2 months of extensive care. He is survived by his wife, Marilyn, and children. If you would like to add a memory, send a note, share a story, or upload a photo, visit obituaries.tridentsociety.com/obituaries, Laguna Woods, California. Or go directly to tridentsociety.com, select obituaries, and search for A. Dwayne Smith. Turning now to the sports page in high school softball, this story by Jeff Linder. You probably won't hit her. She definitely won't walk you. So, how to beat Carly Goodwin? It's a riddle that, so far this season, has gone unsolved. I have a lot less to worry about this season, said Goodwin, a junior at Sigourney High School. I can relax more and focus on things that will bring our team success. Gone is the burden of recruitment. Goodwin committed in October to play softball at the University of Northern Iowa, and with that, gone is another layer, travel ball. I played last year in addition to high school ball because it was the summer to get recruited, she said. By the end of the season, I was just done. Relaxed and rested, Goodwin has put up head-shaking numbers through the first 2 weeks of this season, a 7-0 record and a .40 ERA for starters. Teams are hitting 100 against her. In 35 innings, she has struck out 87 batters and walked none. Zero. That's pretty good, Savage's coach Shelley Striegel understated. That impresses me a lot. Carly worked really hard in the off-season, increasing her productivity. Her college commitment let her body and mind loosen up and play. Another facet has loosened Goodwin's approach. The Class 1A fifth-ranked Savages, 8-0, are scoring and scoring a lot. Sigourney has outscored its competition by 95-3. We've been putting up runs right away in the first and second innings, said Goodwin, who's hitting .536 with 11 runs and 13 RBIs. Goodwin possesses 65 miles an hour heat, and her spin has improved. I try to get ahead of the count. 0-1, 0-2, she said. Maybe I'll waste a pitch, but I don't waste too many. My rise has been working good. Then that makes the change work that much better. Along with being Goodwin's battery mate behind the plate, Josephine Moore is Sigourney's number two pitcher. "Our coaches have left it up to us to call our own pitches," Goodwin said. "We have a great connection, and Moore knows where the ball should be pitched. I only shake her off once or twice a game." 7 of Sigourney's wins come at the expense of South Iowa Cedar League opponents. The other was an 8-1 conquest of West Burlington. In high school baseball, this story by K.J. Pilcher, Blazers getting their groove back. Dyersville Beckman has found more success in the last week. The Blazers have persevered the overlap of spring sports, sharing athletes with soccer and golf for the first couple weeks of the season. As the focus shifted slowly to baseball, Class 2A fifth-ranked Beckman has won 4 straight and 5 of its last 6 games. Beckman has improved to 9-6 overall and is 6-0 atop the River Valley Conference North standings with rival Cascade. "We're battling through it," Beckman coach Ryan Mabe said. "I don't think we've played our best ball yet. We're starting to find our groove a little bit still." For Mabe, the opportunity to lead the program he played for and follow in the footsteps of the late Tom Jenk Jr. and Jenk's longtime assistant Fred Martin seemed surreal at first. The 2008 graduate was a sophomore basketball coach and varsity assistant for Beckman when he had a surprising exchange with Martin, who was officiating a lower-level basketball contest. During halftime of a game, Mabe asked Martin how long he was going to coach. Mabe said Martin responded, "Until you're ready." Mabe followed up a month later, asking if he was serious. Martin assured him he was, and the wheel started in motion. He joined the baseball staff as an assistant last season, assuming more duties as the summer progressed. Jenk won 5 state titles, reaching state 17 times, and posted 1,088 career victories. "I hope to be able to carry on that legacy and put my own thing on it," Mabe said. "I'm not going to be Tom Jenk. The tradition is set, and it's more about keeping that bar high and not lowering it." Interestingly, Mabe met his wife while he played for the Blazers, and she was a stat keeper. After a sweep of Monticello where Luke Sigworth's 2-run home run walked off an 8-6 victory in Game 1, and the Blazers trailed in the 5th until a 4-1 comeback win in the nightcap, they were still in disbelief he was leading the baseball power. She was like, "Are you really that coach?" And I said, "I guess," Mabe said. "I'm getting in a rhythm in my daily routine with everything. It's getting to be not much of a big deal anymore." He has tried to make his mark on players on and off the field. The Blazers receive daily devotions via a text group and emphasize playing for bigger things than the individual, like faith, family, teammates, and the Beckman baseball tradition. "Obviously, it's a big task," Mabe said. "I try to make an impact in different ways beyond baseball." Beckman hasn't skipped a beat with the graduation of key players from last year's state team, a new coach, and a transition from the WAMAC to the RBC. Defense has been the bread and butter early as the pitching staff begins to iron out behind ace Nate Offerman. The offense is developing with Luke Sigworth leading the team with 22 hits and a .512 batting average. Luke Shields is batting at .324 and .559 on base percentage. "The last few games we've done a good job fielding and throwing the ball," Mabe said. "We're doing a good job. We're not going to strike out a lot of guys, so we have to play defense. The guys are working at it. The best ball is in front of us yet, but we're starting to find our stride." Sports of area interest today include high school baseball and softball games. And if you're listening on the radio, the Cubs are at the Angels at 8:30. The Golden Knights are at the Panthers in the NHL Stanley Cup Final. That's 6:30 p.m. on KGYM. Turning now to the Hoopla section, Bang Up Birthday is the title of the front page of the Hoopla. This story is by Diana Nolan for the Gazette. Expect cake, lots of cake, as the Cedar Rapids Freedom Festival celebrates its 40th birthday this year. What began as just an idea in 1983 sparked a downtown fireworks display the following July 4 that drew 5,000 spectators. Fast forward 40 years, and the celebration now spans 3 weeks, attracts 400,000 spectators. Festivities begin on Flag Day, which is June 14, and culminate with the Celebration of Freedom fireworks on July 4. Several affiliated events, including Cedar Rapids Municipal Band concerts, continue through July 12, bringing the total to nearly 70 events. One major change this year is the footprint for the fireworks. With ongoing construction of the flood wall downtown, the fireworks will be shot from the 2nd Avenue Bridge instead of the 1st Avenue Bridge. That means seating is pushed back to just the 3rd Avenue Bridge and the McGrath Amphitheater, with no spectator seating on the 2nd Avenue Bridge and Mays Island. The kids' zone and food vendors will be situated on 1st Street Southwest, from the 3rd Avenue Bridge to the amphitheater. The fireworks musical soundtrack will be broadcast in the seating venues, not synchronized on a local radio station as in the past. We actually looked into it again this year, but we have found that people are listening differently to the radio, said Carol Shepherd, the festival's executive director. They're using apps, which results in a delay, she noted, so it really wouldn't be set to music. Some other details are being kept under wraps. We've got some surprises in store for people that are downtown, Shepherd said. We're really, really excited. We're pulling out the stops for our audience. On July 6, 1999, a Gazette editorial declared, "What a boring weekend this would have been without the Freedom Festival." Not so long ago, this city lacked a July 4 bash. In 1983, local business owner Peter Tian was viewing 4th of July fireworks in Fairfax and noticed how many Cedar Rapids residents were there. He thought his hometown could and should put on a display. By Christmas that year, he had enlisted help from others and requested permission for street closings downtown for the first Celebration of Freedom. Sponsored by the Metropolitan Veterans Council, the one-day event drew just 5,000. By 1988, it sported a new name, Freedom Festival, and had grown to 13 events. Planning has grown to a year-round endeavor headed by Shepherd, events and marketing coordinator Marnie Schultz, marketing assistant Emma Slagle, a 22-member board of directors, and two seasonal interns. And that's not all. It takes a village, Shepherd said, citing the legion of volunteers who help with stuffing 20,000 buttons into packets or assisting activities, including the July 4 festivities downtown. Volunteers who participate in the festival's Win-Win-Win program are paid, in quotes, with monetary donations to the nonprofits of their choice. We funnel thousands of dollars in the community to other nonprofits, said Shepherd, who is in her third year at the helm of the festival, itself a nonprofit organization. The buttons, which debuted at $1 in 1988, are the key to entry for many festival events. Now priced at $10, they are the festival's major fundraiser, helping to finance the $300,000 endeavor. The gold buttons have returned this year and come with a $100 Hy-Vee gift card. 40 gold buttons are stashed among all other buttons being sold at Hy-Vee area grocery stores, drug stores, and fast and fresh stores. Corporate sponsorship and a slice of the city's hotel motel tax revenue also boost the bottom line. New this year, donation buckets will dot the landscape, and a donation link is provided online. Every little bit helps. Every penny, every little dollar helps make sure we can sustain for another 40 or more years, Shepherd said. Very important. I wish that I could have somebody write the $1 million check so everything could be free, but I just don't have that donor, unless you can find one for me. Nods to the past are tucked into the three-week celebration. June 14, kickoff in front of Veterans Memorial Building on the 2nd Avenue Bridge downtown includes the flag retirement ceremony at 6 that evening, That's moving to the Freedom Foundation, 4001 Centerpoint Road, adding live music and food afterwards after the solemn salute. There's a Tribute to Heroes dinner, table decorations at the Tribute to Heroes dinner on June 15 will reflect popular events from the past. This celebration of people who have made positive contributions to the community will be held at the DoubleTree by Hilton Complex downtown. The Kids Parade is back this year, stepping or wheeling off from the Paramount lot at 11:30 on June 24 and continuing to Green Square. Also, movie at the ballpark, one of Shepherd's favorite events, is returning to the Veterans Memorial Stadium June 29. The feature movie is Top Gun Maverick, which begins at 7 p.m. Admission is free with a festival button, and no button is required for kids age 5 and under. Other favorites include the Balloon Glow, 4 to 10 p.m. on June 17th, Doc Dogs, June 22nd to 25th at the Northfields at Kingston Stadium, Music at the Museum, July 4, 5th Season Races, the Pancake Breakfast, Car Show, Celebration of Freedom Fireworks, and 4th of July Concert. And the Freedom Festival isn't the only one marking a milestone. The Cedar Boat Club is celebrating its 75th anniversary with the return of its public fireworks show. At sunset on July 2nd, the event will light the night sky over the Cedar River, downstream of Ellis Harbor, 1700 Ellis Boulevard, Northwest. Prime viewing is the beach across from Ellis Pool. In the food category, in the Hoopla section today, Roy Sands Soul Food from Aaron Jordan for the Gazette. Roy Sands Soul Food Restaurant isn't just a place where owner Roycine Porter serves golden fried chicken wings, steaming macaroni and cheese, and crispy shelled beef tacos. It's where Porter, a Johnson County Board of Supervisors member, meets her constituents, like Kathy Hudepohl, who recently visited the restaurant in the South District Market, a mini food hall on Iowa City's southeast side. She ordered a pork chop, mac and cheese, and candied yams. "It's good," Hudepohl said about her meal. "I live here in the South District, in Saddlebrook, and I noticed what Roy Sand and others have done with the Diversity Market, and now this store. I wanted to come check it out." The dishes on Porter's menu are foods she grew up eating in Saginaw, Michigan. Many come with childhood memories. "Back in the day when we had collard greens, we had to pick them. They were on a plant and you had to pick the leaves off the stem. You cut them up and you have to wash them a couple times to get the grit off," she said, using her hands to repeat the motions she did as a child. "The greens are then stewed with smoked turkey or ham hocks for 4 hours. You can't rush 'em," Porter said. Roy Sands Soul Food serves a daily special for $18 that comes with a choice of fried catfish, a pork chop or chicken wings, and then two sides from a list that includes candied yams, corn on the cob, fried cabbage, mac and cheese, spaghetti, and cornbread. On Thursdays, she also serves 4 deep-fried tacos with rice and beans for $15, or super nachos for $15, or 4 tacos for $12. For dessert, you'll find $3 cups of banana pudding. "I've had a couple of white people say, 'Hey, can you make me a pan of banana pudding for the holiday?' That's one of the big hits," Porter said. The night before the March 25 grand opening, Porter stayed up all night, prepping vegetables and meats and baking cornbread. With Jonathan Simpson, her nephew and head cook, and Tony Curran, they opened at noon. By 5 p.m., all the food was gone. "Business has been wonderful," Porter said. "But it's been an adjustment to balance a new business with work as a supervisor. After initially serving lunch, Porter shifted her hours Wednesday through Friday to 10 to 4 p.m. This allows her to attend county meetings and work sessions earlier in the day. The restaurant is closed Monday and Tuesday. Some customers recognize that Porter is an elected official. They come in here and say, 'You're on the city council.' And I was like, 'Nope, a Johnson County supervisor, she said. Once a customer wanted to talk about city business, and Porter pointed him to Iowa City Council member Pauline Taylor, who just happened to be eating at the restaurant. Iowa City Mayor Bruce Teague eats at Roy Sands Soul Food at least once a week, Porter said. Not only does Porter work with her nephew, but her daughters, Antonia Porter and Stacy Porter, both of Iowa City, come down to help out when the restaurant is busy. The South District Market has three other vendors: the Early Bird Cafe, which serves coffee, wraps, and salads; Cachua Cakes, which serves tortas, Mexican sandwiches, and Tres Leche Cakes; and a store with wide-brimmed hats and other clothing items. The market is in the front of the former Slumberland store. The back part of the building now is Store Local Iowa City, which leases self-storage units. A covered outdoor patio with tables is available if diners want to take their food outside. Tony Curran, who ran for Iowa House District 89 last year but was not elected, chats with customers and promotes the food hall. From the Early Bird Cafe in the morning to Tortas for lunch and then us for dinner, we've got your whole day covered, he said. In brief, if you go, it's called Roy Sands Soul Food, located in the South District Market, 947 U.S. Highway 6, Iowa City. Hours are 4 to 10 p.m. Wednesday to Friday, noon to 9 p.m. Saturday and Sunday. They're closed on Monday and Tuesday. The price range is $3 to $18. And for other information, see Roy Sands Soul Food on Facebook. Finishing up with a brief look at the weather for today. Cedar Rapids' normal high for today is 79. The normal low is 58. The record high of 97 was set in 1963. The record low of 41 degrees was set in 1931. Today we're looking for a high of 78 in Cedar Rapids and a low of 54, 79 for Iowa City and a low of 49. Partly cloudy today and tomorrow, a little warmer tomorrow with a high of 83 and a low of 61. A chance of showers shows up on Saturday with a high of 85 and a low of 59. Mostly cloudy on Sunday, and that high is 77 and a low of 54. We are in the waning gibbous moon phase with moon rise at 1:06 a.m. and set at 11:31 a.m. Sunset tonight is at 8:40 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow at 5:31. That gives us 15 hours and 9 minutes of daylight. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It's Thursday, June 8, 2023. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening, and have a great, safe day.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on EarthDate.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.